Hey team, welcome back to the Student Paramedic Podcast Research Mini-Series. Hey team, welcome back to the Student Paramedic Podcast Research Mini-Series. Today is the very last episode of this Research Mini-Series, and I'm joined again by Dr. Sandy McQuarrie, where we're going to be going through the critical appraisal of evidence. But before we get into that, Dr. Sandy McQuarrie did mention in the very first episode that everyone is on a research continuum or a journey into research, whether they know it or not. And that research journey looks like either being a research agnostic, a consumer of research, or a creator of research. So we've already delved into firsthand experiences, where to start, how to choose a research methodology, which leads us on to our next topic, where we'll be picking Sandy's brain today about what makes a research paper or evidence good. Whether you're looking at research papers as part of your research topic, using it for a university assignment, or looking at the current evidence for a particular medication, piece of equipment, or best practice whilst you're out on the road. So thanks for joining, Sandy. This is something that I've struggled with even now as a paramedic on road, how to actually critically appraise good evidence. And it's something that I've always wanted to know more about. So can we dive into what makes a piece of research or evidence actually good?
Yeah, we can. Absolutely. Thanks for having me back. A couple of things. As you know, and I know, and we're completely surrounded and bombarded by information 24/7. Now, they come in many forms. They come at us, and they're coming at us through social media, through our communication channels at work, through our channels with the person we're having coffee with, from television, radio, and a lot of it is not of what we would call either robust or good quality or quality that you can use to make an informed opinion on. And you'd say, well, I went to Google University, so I'll beg to differ. Everybody's entitled to an opinion, but if you were to rank the robustness of the information presented to us, obviously the things that fall off of some Facebook, although there's some reasonable evidence on Facebook from some good sites. But by and large, you have to have a pretty, perhaps not jaded, but certainly you need to examine what's put in front of you and have that with, take that with a grain of salt. Let's talk about what you might read in terms of studies. So studies are based on research or things that people have seen. So we talk about research as ending up in peer-reviewed journals, in write-ups, in sometimes you see them on other podcasts, and there's lots of good podcasts. But really, think of research that gets presented as either has three levels, kind of bottom, middle, high. And as we go up, the ability for us to make an informed decision, meaning a good quality decision, increases. That bottom level, things like case series studies, observational or descriptive studies, pre and post test research, anecdotal evidence, N of one. So those are the ones that you take with probably a teaspoonful of salt. And as you move upwards, so we're moving towards like a triangle, you're saying, okay, I saw an N of one study where they used naloxone to reverse alcohol overdose. So therefore, should I put it into my practice? The answer would be probably not. You want to see if there's more of the, that's kind of a bottom level. What's in the middle level in terms of robust studies? And they are things like cohort studies, cross-sectional studies. We've all done surveys. Those are cross-sectional studies. Case control studies. They're kind of pretty reasonable in terms of the way you can make a decision based on them. But the top level studies that we really want to say, these are really well done, well designed, published in really good journals, peer-reviewed. They are critically appraised topics, randomized controlled trials, systematic reviews, and meta-analysis where they take a whole bunch of studies and put them together and kind of analyze them all at once. So think of that as a pyramid. with those at the top being the most robust. I'll stop for a minute. What do you think of that?
I mean, it makes a lot of sense, and it's not the first time I've heard that either. So, yeah, it's I guess it's easy to follow there.
It is, and but what we need to pry ourselves away from is the way we consume information. And I don't mean research, but the way we consume. I started being research agnostic, but when I started to consume research, I didn't know quality. I didn't know a good journal from a bad journal, and I didn't know what to make of the results that were published in good quality journals of RCTs. Didn't have any idea. So it took careful supervision, and it took a lot of time for me to get to that point. But just to understand, as they say, when they say the results are based on a really good quality randomized controlled trial, big sample size, published in a good journal, you can place a lot of not trust, but certainly faith that the methodologies were done well, and that you can draw reasonable assertions. There's always kind of caveats to that, but that's consuming what we see as someone presents a case control study to us. Oh, I know where that fits in the hierarchy. Let's go from there. So, are you familiar with how to appraise kind of what's put in front of us in terms of published articles or published studies, Alex?
I mean, to be honest with you, the only thing that I really know about that is the frameworks that they gave to us to use at university, to critically appraise evidence.
Yeah. So when you're trying to figure out if there's one or more studies that are leading you want to investigate something. In my case, it would have been in my early days. Does ASA help patients in the out-of-hospital environment? Remember the early 90s, couldn't find anything. Now you could certainly find things, but there's critical appraisal tools, so you can put them against those studies. And there's a framework, you're right, and you learned about it in uni. And there's a number of them, and they're pretty easy to find. And but what I mean is, you bring them up and you go, all right, I'm gonna now examine the strength of the evidence in this randomized control trial, or in this case control study, or in this anecdotal evidence. The CASP program, Critical Appraisal Skills Program, has checklists, CASP, if you maybe in the show notes, and that's based out of Oxford, actually. So that's the Oxford criteria. Have you heard of that one, Alex?
Yeah, I think that is the one that we use during university.
Yes. Yeah, and I put it up on the top of the ones that I would recommend. So easy to find, and not self-explanatory, but pretty easy to navigate once you get a hold of them. There's others, of course. Center for Emergency-Based Medicine has a checklist of critically appraising. But what we mean by critically appraising is looking at it with this really intense scrutiny, with a series of questions to say, was the sample size good? Was the methodology sound? Were they blind, or were they double blinded? What was the sort of peer review it went through? All those sorts of things will be found. They're common to all checklists, and they're easy for us to put up against a study that we want to know a little bit more about. Whether we're on standby in an ambulance, or we're off the road and doing some research for our service, anything like that. There's more. Joanna Briggs Institute has a checklist as well, JBI, and perhaps we'll put them all in the show notes so people can find them. But the nice thing about all of them is that they can be applied, if you have a particular favorite, but they can be applied to either one paper or a series of papers. And that's a really good starting point. But I think before we go too much further, we probably need to talk about what a peer-reviewed published journal article should look like, what it might look like, and what it shouldn't look like. How's about that?
Yeah, that sounds good because that's something that we hear thrown around all the time.
I know. So I'm unfortunately spammed in my academic email from journals who promise me if I send them anything and some money, they're going to publish me in the journal of, and sounds quite good. They're unfortunately 99% predatory. And I'll use that term if you've heard it before, I'm not sure, but predatory journals are those that are less, they're quasi or not scientific. Their job is to get you published in a format that might satisfy some people at a superficial level, and they almost always do it for money. And unfortunately or fortunately, I keep an eye out for them. In fact, usually when I'm reading a piece of literature that I'm not familiar with the journal, I will put the journal name into Google and I put the term predatory journal beside it. And sometimes you get a hit, sometimes you don't. There are, of course, lists of predatory journals that are changing all the time. But in general, if the listeners are new to research, there's a couple of hallmarks that if you're checking out a journal to say, this one seems to be of good quality. So, what do you know about peer-reviewed journals, Alex?
To be fair with you, the only thing that I know about them is that they are peer-reviewed by people within the field.
They absolutely are. We can do all the research that we want, qualitative, quantitative, case study, RCT, semi-structured interviews, phenomenologic approach. But until we give it to our peers to tear apart, to read, to deconstruct, to give us feedback on, it's not generally accepted as a piece of work with merit. And the end result is when we see our work published in a peer-reviewed journal of good standing, then we say that it's met at least that bar. Now, there's all sorts of things going on in the background with the way stats are presented and, doing online versus, pay for play. But in general, publishing in a peer-reviewed journal of good standing is a good measure or a good place to say, all right, what I'm reading in this journal is good. Do you know what a journal impact factor is, Alex?
Never heard of it.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that, as well as checking out whether a journal's predatory or not, I usually will check to see a journal's impact factor. Now, an impact factor is really, it's a measure of the frequency with which an average article in any journal has been cited in any one year. So any number greater than one means that for every article in there, it's been cited at least one time somewhere in that year. And if you have, so the higher that number, the impact factor number, by extension, you could say the higher the quality of the journal. So impact factors of one is pretty average, so kind of one citation per article per year. Three is considered really good, and 10 is remarkable. Do you know which journal in the year has a journal in the world has one of the highest impact factors?
No, I'm not sure. Which one is it?
Nature. The journal Nature.
We'll have to put that in our show notes.
Yeah, so it's 69.5. So, and there's a small claim to fame. My dad published an article in Nature in 1958.
Oh, wow.
So I'll never get in Nature, but he did. So that's him. He did really well. So journal impact factors. So sometimes I'll put the journal name in and I'll put the words impact factor beside it and it'll come up. Shimago is kind of the clearinghouse for rating any journal in the world. And I tend to use that a lot. And the other rating that we can get concerned about is called the Q rating. So impact factor, non-predatory impact factor, and Q rating, which stands for quartile rate rankings, I should say. And it's an indicator of, kind of how prestigious the journal is. They're rated into quartiles. So Q1 journals, you're in the top 25%, Q2, Q3, Q4. Q1s being the top 25%. So when we select a journal to publish in general, we'll ask ourselves, what's the impact factor? And what's the Q rating? And academia and unis will say, always publish in the highest impact factor, always publish in the highest Q rating journal that you can. The flip side of that is they become incredibly hard to publish in as the numbers go up and up and up. So those are frameworks of quality. Now there are thousands of journals in the world, and the rate of new knowledge that's being accrued into these journals is it's exponential. So it's so hard to keep up. As a tip, and this, you can use this tip as well, Alex, I always say to this my students when they start a research journey is find some keywords around your what you're interested in and put them into Google Scholar alerts. And for me, I routinely I'll search the terms heart rate variability and paramedic because that's kind of where I research. So every week, it'll scan all of those journals and it'll find the four or five or six most relevant ones and it'll send them to me. And I'll say, yep, I need that one. No, I don't need that one. Or that one makes no sense. So if you're interested in, you know, in your case, we talked about seeing your podcast change the way people's, you know, knowledge, skills, or attributes, you know, change because of listening to your podcast. You might want to put in keywords of knowledge translation and podcast and see what comes forward from the journals into your inbox every week. It's easy. And if you can turn them off anytime. So anybody that studies with me usually will have four or five or six Google Scholar alerts going all the time. Do you have, I'll stop for a minute. Questions about that?
No, I think you mentioned that as well earlier on in this series, and I think it's a fantastic tool and tip to have because, one, I never heard of that before, and I think even as a student, even if you're not, say, conducting a research paper or something like that, it's still great for, say, your university topic, your assignment that you're doing.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. So those are kind of some of the ways I approach either picking a journal or reading about a journal. Scimago, S-C-I-M-A-G-O, is a clearinghouse of all the journals in the world that rates them by curating and impact factor. I'm wary of predatory journals. I never answer those spam emails ever. Especially when they promise to publish you within a week. Having been through the process for a while, kind of the average, not average, but it certainly takes certainly weeks to months to get a publication in and reviewed and revised and reviewed again and revised again and then perhaps accepted. So it's I'm always wary when I read the date submitted and date published on the bottom of every article that you'll see. You know, if the span is less than 4 weeks, I'm really kind of suspicious. I'm thinking, how did that get through that fast? And as a researcher putting it out there, sometimes there's a hard time finding researchers to peer review. And I'm a peer reviewer. And it can be months just finding a peer reviewer. So sometimes that slows things down. So we talked about the hierarchy of evidence and kind of bottom, middle, and high. RCTs are at the top. We talked about journals where we think good research should live. And unfortunately, and I'll say this quite honestly, publishers make a lot of money off of people's research by putting the results behind paywalls. And the paywall means that you have to pay to read the article or you have to pay to publish the article, even in good journals. They're obviously for profit, and that's the way it goes. I try and publish open access as much as I can. And that means that everybody can, I don't pay to publish it and they don't pay to read it. It's hard. It's very, very hard. So, you know, we get grants to do research and we use our time to do research. And then sometimes we're facing a bill of several thousand dollars to make our research available to the wider world. So I have a hard time balancing that sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting because during this episode, you've spoken about a lot of things that I've never heard of, and I'm sure many of our listeners haven't heard of either, because when we talk about sort of critically appraising evidence, I never would have considered, you know, things like the submission of the paper and the actual publication of it, you know, to be quite important, and obviously these predatory journals and things like that. So it's fascinating that you're going through all of this, because I think obviously there are all the bits that you can pick apart as per those frameworks that you spoke about, and those can be accessed by people. But these are the kind of things that I don't think I ever learned at university or had ever heard of prior to today.
That's true. That is true. The other type of research that you probably have already read and is quite prevalent in terms of I want to read something about a subject, as opposed to one randomized controlled trial about the use of aspirin in the pre-hospital setting, you might read a systematic review of the use of ASA or aspirin in the pre-hospital environment. We should probably talk a little bit about that because it's oftentimes where you'll see really interesting stuff because they put together a whole bunch of RCTs or good quality evidence. Are you familiar with what a systematic review is, or at least a structured review?
Yeah, I've definitely come across those during my time at university, and whilst having a look at research whilst I've obviously come out of university and I'm on the road now.
Yeah, let's get into it. So systematic reviews form parts of almost everybody's honors. And we talked about honors, master's, PhD. And one of the first things that these students do is they go to the literature and following, again, guidelines like Joanna Briggs or Cochrane or others, that they'll search systematically the entire kind of database of good quality literature to find who has done anything in that area before you did. So the idea is, there's a number of ways that we can look at reviews in terms of, you know, whether it's a narrative review, which is a little less structured, a scoping review, which means we're just getting started, a systematic review, which has, you know, which you register with a group called Prospero and is very, very within a box, but good guidelines. So whether you, which one you choose to do, your first one, that's one thing, but reading them, the systematic reviews and the Cochrane reviews are very high quality. So they'll take, done well, they would have searched the literature. They would have parsed out the ones that weren't of good quality. They would have critically appraised using those CASP checklist or CEBM or GBI and said, that's a good article. That's going in the systematic review. And they gather them all up. They follow what's called a PRISMA diagram or PRISMA flowchart, I should say. And they'll end up with a number of them. And then they'll talk generally about all of them. And then they'll say, we can now say, because we looked at 10 good quality RCTs about ASA in the pre-hospital field, and, you know, 8 of them were really good. One was just fair and one we shouldn't even pay attention to. Based on the evidence, we would recommend that ASA be used in pre-hospital care. Now, obviously, everybody knows that it is, but that would be when I first started in the early 90s, none of this was available. So systematic reviews, of which there can be a narrative, a scoping, you know, a systematic, those sorts of things are really good ways to start reading about cool literature. Or when you're ready to dip your toe in the water in terms of, you know, I'm forming an opinion that I'd like to do some research and I'd like to publish the research. Understanding that doing an RCT with a full-time job as a paramedic, for instance, is probably going to be pretty hard. We talked about having to, you know, finding researchers and making friends with them and seeing what they want to research. Systematic reviews are a really good way to get started. A really, really good way. Yeah. You know, you still have a PICO question and you're still evaluating literature, and some of it might be good, some of it might be bad, with co-authors that might be researchers who have published before, or even if they're new to the idea, can make it through. And journals want these. Journals want these systematic reviews. Using our example from our last time we chatted about, you know, let's examine how the effect of a podcast might change someone's attitude or learning. You would do a systematic review on that, or maybe even a scoping review, as the very first thing you would do. Go to literature, follow the guidelines, write it up, and get it published. Do you think you could do something like that, Alex?
Yeah, it sounds, when I say straightforward, I know it'd be a lot of work, but it sounds very straightforward, yeah.
It is straightforward. And again, we're not trying to get this in Nature. We may want to place this in a journal with an impact factor of 0.6. That's not a predatory journal. That's just a reasonable journal. And those are, you know, for budding researchers, novice researchers, new researchers, those are good goals. As you get into more, furthering your research and furthering your career, certainly your university will push you towards high impact factor, high Q rating journals. But in the meantime, you can dip your toe in that water, and it's I'm going to say it's work, but it's really good work. There's probably some other places that researchers, budding researchers, researchers that are listening now that even don't know the researchers, can try out some of this research writing. Would you like to know about them?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, I'll turn this right around on you and say, tell me about the time that you published in the Shift Extension magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was really lucky. I got to, after meeting you, go do a research day where we got to go to a really cool place and do a scenario wearing one of the Hexa skins, which you introduced in the first episode. And it was really cool. Got to learn more about my own stress response in regards to being in a scenario and doing the work. And so that was quite fascinating. And so as a result of all that data and that experience, whilst I was just going there as sort of the crash test dummy for a research project that you guys were going to do a bit later on, I got to write about that experience. And so I wrote about my experience into research, and that was a really cool way. You really did spark my sort of imagination into research, because before that I didn't really have much to do with it, and it's become something, obviously now we're doing a mini series and it's something I'm interested in. And so I got to write about that experience, which was fantastic, and got to publish that into the Shift Extension podcast. And whilst it's not, you know, a literature review or, you know, something that necessarily is going to change practice, I hope it sort of maybe gives some people some inspiration into starting their own journey into it.
Isn't that something? Yeah, and I don't know if you tell your listeners or not, but I certainly encourage you to write about that experience, because it was a pretty cool experience. And how did we get you into that experience in the first place? You were somewhere at the right time. I think you and I had just interviewed my students, and I said, we're going to go to Brisbane and do some immersive simulation. Would you like to come?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be fair with you, we met at one of the Free Radicals CPD events, and I just wanted to interview you on the podcast, and you said, hey, let's get on quite a few of your students. And it was fantastic. And after that, obviously we kept in contact, and from there you've inspired me into doing all sorts of different things into research, something that I never really thought that I'd have any kind of interest in, but here we are.
So you used you submitted yours to a journal called the Shift Extension, which is an Australian-based journal, although it's worldwide. It's ISBN registered. It's run by a guy named Steve Whitfield, and he's the chief editor. I'm an editor. Think of it as, it's not the rigor of a peer-reviewed journal of a high-impact factor. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. It's a group of budding researchers who are editors who will take your proposal, your article, and we'll edit it, and we'll help you with the peer review, peer review light, and get you published so you can see what you've done and others can see what you've done. And you were a perfect example. So there are publications like that. I know JPP is like that, in Journal of Paramedic Practice is like that in Britain, International Paramedic Practice, which is both, I think, associated with your college. I've published in International Paramedic Practice. Like, they're there for, they're certainly above the Shift Extension, but are certainly ways in. And your professional association has their own journals to get that sort of thing going. And there's other places to kind of put out those small research steps. Some are poster events at conferences. Student Paramedics Australasia has their own research conference. Australasian College of Paramedic has their own big annual conference, which has a scientific stream. And there are, of course, any number of organizations like Australia Tactical Medical Association, ATMA, has the same thing, poster presentations. And they welcome these sorts of things. And I've had students put in small research projects. They put in lit reviews. In fact, the last 2 years at ACP, Australasian College of Paramedicine, the scientific poster stream was won by our students for 2 years in a row based on published systematic lit reviews that they've done for a respiratory course. So you're thinking, I'm sitting on these assessment items and, you know, I did a good job on them, and now no one's ever going to see them again, like, ever. That's the sort of thing that you send along to Steve Whitfield at the Shift Extension, for instance, or think of putting it together as a poster in some of these places. And you'd be surprised how people want to see you succeed, and people want to see you put a poster up. People want to give you the floor for 10 minutes. We had students last year at Griffith who wanted to know about the topic of emotional seriousness. Do you know much about that, Alex?
No, I don't, but it sounds intriguing, and I'd like to know what it's about.
You're just about to. Emotional seriousness was a term that I value highly when I do highly immersive simulation, high fidelity simulation. And I try and impress upon the students in their third year to be emotionally serious, present, not with the giggles, role playing to the full extent, not come out of character, and then be prepared afterwards to maintain that seriousness during a structured feedback and a Socratic debrief. And if you think back to your own simulation days, there's probably times that you hit that mark, and there's probably times where either you or others around you didn't hit that mark. So I was trying to impress upon the students, I said, you need to be emotionally serious. And one of them looked at me, his name was Oscar Lachlan, and he said, what does that mean? And I said, you need to go away and find out and tell me what you think it means. And he did. He and his classmates came back to me, and they had done an article, and they published it in the Shift extension. In fact, it's in the winter issue. It's in this issue. They got invited to U.S. University of Sunny Coast's student day, and they presented there. They presented on emotional seriousness, and it's a perfect example of, so now they're going out into the workplace and they're sitting across from employers, and they may be able to present this as one more thing that might make them a more fully well-rounded paramedic. And I can say to that cohort, they've all got jobs, and not just due to that, they're pretty cracking good students. But I call it dip your toe in the water. And the Shift extension posters, Australian Paramedic Journal, which is run by Amy Cotton in Victoria, and should be searchable online. We'll take that sort of content. There's certainly the ability to present some of your stuff in podcast form, and really the sky's the limit. And you can start to push some of these things on social media as well. Keeping in mind, if you're going to do research, there's some research, a lot of research that requires ethical approval by an institution before you start. The things that Oscar and his friends researched didn't need that. But you need to be, of course, be able to say, we didn't need ethics for this particular case. It was essentially a case study, and off they went. So you're a person that's put forward your first step, and you're across a number of disciplines. So you're the typical paramedic who is well positioned to do research, and you've now heard, across all of these podcasts, some approaches, some new terms, and perhaps you're not sitting in that research methods course going, I wish this was over. I wish this course was over. And that's, it's hard to teach research. So I'm trying to make it, a little more digestible, or break it down into bite-sized chunks, because that's what I needed for me. So, speaking on behalf of those that are at the front end, what do you think of all of that?
I think this entire series, you've really broken it down and made it digestible, definitely. And because you're so enthusiastic and passionate about it, it's hard not to be so motivated and excited, inspired to do research. So I think, you've really opened up my eyes to new research terms and topics and things I'd never heard of before. But again, it's been so that I now go forth and go, oh, I really want to do like a research article. I want to get started. I want to do something, even if it is just starting to consume a bit more research, for my daily practice and start thinking about what I can research in. So, I mean, you've really broken it down, and I think, and hopefully our listeners have really resonated with what you've said and can get started. I know we've done some little tips and tricks on how to get started, but I think it'd be a great way for you to sum up this series on what you would like people to do who are interested and who are inspired to get started. Where do they go?
I know. You need to figure out where you're on that continuum. Like, honestly, are you agnostic? Are you consuming a lot? Are you consuming a lot of, poor quality? Or are you an actual, you're kind of doing research. So wherever you are on the continuum, turn to your left or to your right. Okay. So if you're at the other end, I'm at, you know, probably further towards creation. I've turned to my left and I'm finding you and I'm pulling you along that continuum. So that's my job. And that's what I do. And that's what I should do. I pull Oscar Loughlin, Amy, Ali Ringers, Steve Whitfield. And I find them and I say, let's do research together. Or sometimes they find me. Jasmine Sidhu, Chloe Dietlifs, we've students that have said it, like to learn a little bit more, and I pull them. If you're at the other end of the continuum, you're just leaving agnostic and you realize, I should know a little bit more. Look to your right and try and find someone in your circle, your circle of friends, your circle of service, your circle of research area, your circle of uni, wherever you happen to be, and say, I think I'd like to try a systematic review. I think I'd like to try to write up a case study. I think I'd like to try and put something in the shift extension. And then, you know, that person, if he's within hailing distance, it'd be me, maybe someone else. And if not, reach out anyway. Reach out to those organizations I talked about, JPP, IPP, Shift Extension, some of those, and say, I've got an idea for an article. And you know me, every time you come and see me, you usually leave with a job, right? And that's me looking, you know, to my left to make sure I see you there. Oscar, you know, left with a job. Ali left with a job. They all leave with jobs, but they all succeeded in those jobs. So think about where you are. Think about where you are on the continuum. If you're, you know, well-versed in academia and research, help somebody, right? Help somebody. And if you've got a research, I've always had summer research students and honors college students, and I always make sure they get a project they can finish and they learn some skills and they get hopefully a paper or a poster out of it. But if you're you and you are, I know where you are on the continuum, you look around your circle and see who's closest that can help me, even if it's geographically not close. He's in Australia, then reach out. You know, you should be doing probably a narrative lit review on the educational value of podcasts, for instance. That's my subliminal message.
Yeah, I definitely have a job to do.
I know. And it's the sort of thing that once you take a wander through the literature, you go, this doesn't interest me at all. Not at all. Not in the least little bit. Or when you can't find anything, you're going, oh, I need to do something about that. And that was the case for my original PhD research. There wasn't a lot in the area. And I was getting more and more excited because I thought I can make new knowledge. And really, you know, what I would sum it up as by saying is your job as a researcher, even though you may wear a hat that says paramedic on the front, is to create new knowledge that never existed before and then share it. That's what you do as a researcher. And it's pretty powerful. New research, new content, new knowledge, new ways of doing things, new techniques, new ways to use drugs, new. And that's your stamp.
Absolutely. I think that is very powerful. And I feel like we're in a position now where as a paramedic profession, we can't be research agnostic anymore, especially with how it's going. I really hope that this mini series has changed some of our listeners' mindsets towards research and hopefully given them some inspiration into getting started and sparked that imagination. Because every time I talk to you, Sandy, like I said, I've got a job to do. Like you said, you give everyone a job to do. But it is really fascinating, and I feel like we need those people in research. So I'm really glad that we've got you on this podcast, hopefully sparking that kind of imagination and inspiration for people who are listening. We've delved into your journey, Abby Little's journey. We've gone through how to get started, what kind of research methodologies are out there. And today we have gone through critically appraising evidence and, you know, finalizing this mini series. So it's been fantastic. Obviously, all the topics that we've spoken about are available to read even further into via the textbook Introducing, Designing, and Conducting Research for Paramedics, which again, it's the textbook that when I first came to you, you recommended that I read. And then we just reached out to Elsevier, and they were really kind in giving us 5 textbooks to give away. So we really do want our listeners, we want you guys to have a read of it, because it is fantastic, and hopefully it'll help you on your journey into moving away from research agnostic to a consumer of research, and then hopefully creating some research. And Sandy, I just want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to record this mini series with me. When I first came to you with this idea of wanting to change some ideas and some attitudes around research, I couldn't think of a better person, and I'm really glad that you said yes.
Well, we've had a great association. It's not over yet, of course. And like I said, when you come talk with me, you usually end up with a job. So it's been a pleasure. I think I can translate. You sense my level of enthusiasm and passion, and that's a big difference in it for me. But even if, as I grew that passion, I wasn't always this passionate. I still knew that I wanted to do something in this area. And I'm here, you know, did a PhD and have published papers and research projects and grants and presentations. But this series is maybe the best of it all, because it's going to influence those that are somewhere to the left of me. And I'm looking for you.
Well, on that note, Sandy, thank you again for joining me on this research mini series. I really appreciate it. You have a new company and website, which we're going to link below, but what is it, and how can people get into touch with you to ask you more questions and hopefully begin their journey into research?
That's true. I've left academia to start the Edge Human Performance Group. If you put the website down below, one part of that company is to help people start in research. Absolutely. And that's all I'll say. Go to the website. My details are there, and people are taking me up on it, and it's working. Yeah. Thank you, Alex. It is a pleasure. This is a phenomenal podcast. I don't know if you bugged me about this or I bugged you about this, but it's always a good combination.
Well, team, there you have it. That is the end of our very first mini series. This research mini series has been an absolute journey. I have learned so much about research that I never knew prior, thanks to Dr. Sandy Macquarie. If you have any questions, you want to get to know more about research, please let us know. We can get you in touch with Dr. Sandy Macquarie, or you can also go down into the show notes and click on the link to his website. Please keep an eye out for the textbook Introducing, Designing, and Conducting Research for Paramedics, as this textbook will help you with your research, especially if you're new to it and you want to get started into it, and the topics that we have spoken about on this podcast are something that you'd like to learn more about. So please keep an eye out for that textbook. You can go onto Elsevier to get your hands on one. Otherwise, you can also keep an eye out for our giveaway, which is all over our social media. This is hopefully the very first of hopefully multiple different types of mini series on different topics. So keep an eye out for that. But thank you again for joining us on the Student Paramedic Podcast.